This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
Jen, I just have to say to you, because we haven't really talked about it yet, mazel tov on Jen and Ben.
It's been pretty exciting for me, you know, from one Jennifer Lynn to another. I feel like my work here is done.
So funny.
You know, I honestly, it's like embarrassing. I don't really care about them as much as I pretend to on social media, but I was genuinely touched by the Jennifer Lopez Ben Affleck wedding.
Well, she also made, and I'm sure somebody else wrote it for her, but she made a really touching statement about the other people who were there when they were getting married, and that one was a male couple, and I know she has a child who's non-binary.
Yes.
And yeah. It seems like J-Lo's kind of like educated herself and, you know, been accepting and supportive, which made me happy because, you know, the worst celebrity interview I ever did was with J-Lo.
You know what? You've said this before. J-Lo has affected both of our careers, but I got fired because of J-Lo from Glamour because whatever age discrepancy, but wait, tell me, why was she the worst interview?
I did. It was right before I got the job to do Lucky. Mm-hmm. And I got a call from Elle magazine to profile her. Mm-hmm. And she was it was when she was moving into a music career. So she wasn't huge yet.
Okay.
But she was dating Puffy and pretending she wasn't with Puffy.
Okay. Okay.
And she was going to go speak at a school somewhere in the Queens or the Bronx.
Okay.
I think Queens. And we were in the car, and at one point my mom was a jewelry designer and Jennifer Lopez had bought one of her pieces. So at one point I said, oh, by the way, and I grabbed her arm.
Oh.
You don't touch. You never touch the famous people.
The famouses cannot be touched.
The famouses cannot be touched. So I touched her. So that got off. She showed no, she didn't have to show warmth even. She was just not very respectful. Mm-hmm. She did the interview with me as she got a manicure. And I went, it was at the Carlisle Hotel. Mm-hmm. I went to Zittimer Pharmacy, which is a fancy pharmacy on the Upper East Side, which is right next to the Carlisle, and bought like an $80 candle, then went home and took to bed for 2 days.
Did you get a piece out of it?
I got a piece. It wasn't, you know, I mean, it was just a standard celebrity profile.
My worst celebrity interview was Molly Sims, who plucked her mustache and chin hair during our interview.
Yes.
Just in the mirror, just plucking. I mean, God love them. I know what it must be like being an animal in a zoo. I can't even imagine what fame is like.
I can't either, but they chose it.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
They chose it. And even still, I think, you know, I mean, it's not, I don't know. I think it's not entirely fair to say they chose it, so they have to deal with it. But it does sound creepy. I mean, I was talking to a guy yesterday, mm-hmm. Who's in a band, that one of these jam bands, a pretty successful jam band.
Okay.
And he was saying that the FBI actually has files on some of the people who stalk them. And they're not even like a huge band, but they're big enough. Like, wow. So the stalking is pretty creepy.
Yeah, the stalking is, I mean, look, the whole thing is creepy. The economy of celebrity is creepy, and influencers and fame. And it's just, imagine having that many people thinking about you.
Yep.
Just like energetically being in the world. Like I have like a speck. I am like a flea in the kind of like fame that Jennifer Lopez has. But like I was just telling you before we got on, I've been tussling with people on the internet with just like my minor public figureness. People have been coming at me. And it's just weird because people find you. I don't understand the instinct to harass people you don't know. Like, I don't think I've ever even left like a bad Yelp review because right. I feel like, oh, well, maybe they were having a bad day. I don't know. Like, I just don't want to fuck with people.
Yeah.
I don't understand the instinct to reach out to people and try to make them feel bad. I don't understand the instinct to tell people you don't like their work, to tell them, to announce to them you're going to stop following them. I don't, like, why? Who gives a shit?
Oh, I know. I've gotten a fair amount of that. So, I know. Yes. I think it's a certain type of person in a certain kind of mood.
Yeah. And
lashes out like that.
I mean, yeah. Yeah. It's not right. It's not right. And then imagine you're so famous and everybody is projecting. Like, it just warps your brain. Like, that's it.
It does warp your brain. And as soon as you get very famous, you get everything for free.
Yeah.
People stop telling you the truth about yourself.
Yeah.
I was watching a video, I don't know why, on my phone. And it was of these fans standing in front of Justin Bieber's home. And it must have been his apartment in New York. And they're going, can I have a hug? Can I have a hug? And Justin Bieber very calmly says to them, you know, you guys, I really appreciate your support, but this is where I live. This is where I have privacy. And it would really mean a lot to me if you guys stopped coming here. And the girl goes, can I have a hug?
Oh, well, it's like Tom Hanks, the nicest man in the world. Did you see when?
Yes, I saw that footage.
When he was coming out of the restaurant with his wife and the people just swarmed them and she trips and he just looks at them. He's like, back the fuck off.
Yeah.
And it's like they all have their phones out and we just have to get an image of Tom Hanks. And oh my God, I had this experience and I'm going to share it on social media. Imagine being the recipient of that.
I can't.
No,
I can't.
Me neither. So I have compassion, but also I didn't even say anything clever about the Jennifer Lopez, Ben Affleck nuptials. I just put the pictures of them and wrote, this seems kind of nice. And I got my tweet went viral. So, I mean, yeah. And it was also like, yeah, seems nice now. They'll be divorced in a year. It's like, shut the fuck up. Like,
yeah. So like, they'll have a good year. I'm still happy for them.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm still happy for them. What else is going on in your life?
Well, I am on tour.
Yes.
With Paul and his students. The tour with John Anderson of Yes ends tonight, and then the tour with Gibby Haynes of the Butthole Surfers starts tomorrow.
Wait, for anybody who doesn't know, let's just explain, because this is a continuity thing. Kim's boyfriend, you explain, so that people know what this experience is.
My boyfriend, Paul, is a music teacher. He teaches kids music. He founded School of Rock, and now he has something called the Paul Green Rock Academy, and it is an audition-only program for kids who are really serious about having a career in music. And they tour with these various, you know, artists, former arena rockers and things like that. And I go with them and ride on the tour bus and stay in crappy tour hotels. And it's super fun.
Yeah, no, you're a tour wife. It's
I am.
As discussed many times, I love this later in life development for you, because I feel like it would have been such a different experience in like your teens or 20s, you know?
Yeah.
Than it is now. It's just, it must be different. What do you do when you go to a new city? What do you look for?
Well, going on tour makes you realize why rock stars do drugs, because it's late nights, mm-hmm. early mornings, and it's like people just calibrate their bodies, you know, right. with drugs.
Right, right.
Because their internal clocks get so screwed up. So, you know, I like work. You know, I try to get work done when I can.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I've discovered an amazing product.
Bring it. Tell me.
Downy Wrinkle Release.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
I was like, I got to get a travel steamer to bring on this trip, because my clothes are always all wrinkled from being in the suitcase. And so mm-hmm. I bought a steamer, but it was.
Oh my God. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I thought you meant face wrinkles.
That's hilarious.
Okay. Continue.
A clothing steamer. And the travel steamer I bought was pretty big. And I was like, I don't want to bring this. This is a drag. So I got this stuff, mm-hmm. and you spray it on your clothes. Then you hang up a shirt or whatever. Mm-hmm. You get it just damp. Mm-hmm. You smooth the shirt out with your hands. And then when it dries in a few minutes, it is pretty unwrinkly.
That's a miracle product. I feel
it's a miracle travel product for sure.
Yeah. I feel like that's really good. So you're on tour, and we should explain that you've been on tour. So I've been doing, I did a couple of interviews, including the one that is today's show solo, because you have been hard to track down for a whole hour with your movement and schedule. You've been hard to have a consistent Wi-Fi connection for that long.
Yes.
And I did this interview today that we're releasing today with a woman named Angela Garbus, who I've been following for years. And Angela writes about motherhood a lot. But what's interesting about her work is she's really expanding the definition of motherhood to caregiving and mm-hmm. to sort of like being more of a role we play, whether we're mothers or not. And the fact that raising children or caregiving for elderly is, her book is called Essential Labor, and it is essential to our society and should be treated as such. Mm-hmm. So we had a whole conversation about that I think was pretty life affirming, and she's just a sort of magnificent person I was really grateful to have on, but I did miss you a lot.
I would be so scared to interview someone without you.
No, it's weird. It's weird to interview someone without you. And like, it's like a phantom limb. Like there's like, I'm just expecting you to like come in and chime in something. I'm like, oh, nope, just me alone. So yeah, let's get into it. Our guest today is Angela Garbus. Angela is the author of the national bestseller, Essential Labor, Mothering as Social Change, which has been called a landmark and a lightning storm, a gift that will be passed hand to hand for years by the New Yorker. Her first book, Like a Mother, a book that I love, was an NPR Best Book of 2018, a finalist for the Washington State Book Award in Nonfiction, and deemed excellent by the New York Times. Angela's writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Cut, New York, Bon Appetit, and featured on Fresh Air and The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Welcome, Angela. Hi.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for having me.
You are so welcome. I am so excited to talk to you about this book, both as a mother myself, but as a person with a complicated relationship to mothering and my own mother. This book brought up a lot of really powerful things for me. First, I just want to say congratulations on this book. It's honestly, it's so beautiful. It's intimate, warm, expansive. It's the most courageous book about caregiving that I've ever read.
Oh my God, that's so nice. Thank you. I might start crying at some point.
It's all right. We'll just cry our way through this whole thing.
I mean, I am like primed for, there's something about this moment. I mean, obviously the last like 2 months since launching this book, like, as you mentioned, there's been a really amazing reception that I never could have anticipated. Very validating, but really like has been sort of dreamlike. But then it's all happening in this cultural moment where, like, I'm talking about this stuff I wish I didn't have to, honestly. And then, I mean, I have to ground it in where I'm at, like, in this particular day today, too. Like, I've been prepared for the fall of Roe. Like, I've known this is coming for years. But I've actually been really taken aback by how, since it happened, the violence of it, the violence that we're living in, has really been destabilizing for me and pretty rage-inducing. And I honestly feel like at any moment when I'm like moved to any emotion, I feel like it could go any way, right? Yeah. Like, I feel like I could just break down and cry. I feel like I could have as someone who has struggled with anger issues throughout her life, I feel like I could just fucking go off. I don't really know. Like, I feel really raw in this moment.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And I maybe, you know, when you said that this is like a, you in this like sort of intimate and vulnerable book, like I felt that way writing it. I felt pretty free. Yeah. It just turns out it's just continuing into this moment in my life.
I found that really interesting because I think that you said that you set out to write a history of caretaking and a book about social change. But at some point you must have realized, okay, I'm just going to tell my own story, because this book is a lot of memoir too, right?
Yeah.
How did that choice happen creatively? I mean, it's such a shift, because I know in writing memoir is just like on top of all this other shit.
If I thought, I mean, this question goes deep. So if I thought that I was writing a memoir, like I never would have written this book. Like there is something where, I don't know, like for me, I hate saying this, but it's true. As a person of color, as a woman of color, like I know that my story has inherent value, but I'm very aware, like in the market, it's not a story that people want to hear. And it's, you know, my own sort of internalized racism and whiteness and misogyny that is like, no one actually really cares about my story. Like, so a lot of my writing is like, I mean, I worked as a food writer. I did restaurant reviews, and I was always interested in telling people's stories. But I've always had this feeling of like, I could never write a memoir. My story would not be enough. I have to have this element of like service journalism to it, something that's useful, which, you know, honestly, like I'm too old. I can't remake who I am, right? But I sort of like that about my work. And I do like writing personal narrative, but personal narrative to me is, it's a very interesting thing with writing, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Like, it's actually the more specific that you get, that it feels more universal to people.
Yeah.
It's a weird trick that I still can't totally wrap my mind around.
Yeah, no, and I hear you, because I wrote a career advice book that was really a memoir. but I felt safer hiding behind, you know, here's advice and here's, but really, actually, it's true. The more, it's more honest. It's more specific, but it's more honest, right? It's like the more honest you are, the more people, exactly what you said, identify with the story, because it's not hiding behind the tricks of service journalism, which is like not real at all for the most part, you know? It's like you've been assigned the thing and you're like, I'll figure out how to write about this.
I know. You know what I mean? Every aspect of that, I'm always like, I mean, it's what you want. Exactly. Here's what I think, but you should just do what you want.
Totally. And writing a book that you want is the most terrifying thing possibly in the world. And exposing yourself and being like, I think this is what I want to say.
Yeah.
Is just a revolutionary act, to be honest.
So, yeah. No, I mean, thank you. And I feel like that's what I did. I told my husband this the other day, and I don't mean it to be dramatic, but I was like, I feel like this book saved me in a lot of ways. Like, and especially, I mean, I'm so glad to be talking to you for this podcast too, because I think I'm obsessed with middle age and the stage that I'm at in my life. Like, I feel like I wrote this book, and I mean, I want to get to your actual question about like how this shift happened. But what I found was, to start generally, really, that in writing about mothering, it was very humbling to realize like I could not write about mothering without really confronting how I was mothered and my own daughtering. You know, it's not a verb you hear very often, but I really had to examine that. And I had to accept the ways in which I was mothered by someone who is just a person, a flawed human who could never give me all of the things that I needed and wanted. And I think I spent a lot of my 20s and like teenage years being really angry at my mother for that. And not seeing that she was, you know, an immigrant from a new country who was so adaptable and just surviving, just making it work and doing her best. Yeah. And I feel like I'm at this place where I, you know, my mother does not need me to forgive her, but like, I feel like I've gone through that process of forgiving her and finding peace, like in that. And a lot of this book was really about, this was a lot of the surprises. I wrote a lot about the ways in which I have mothered myself.
Yes. Yes.
In part because mothering myself leads me to being the person that actually then, one, it makes me more of a whole person so I can be a happy person living a good life, but it also makes, it allows me to be the person who can show up for my children and mother them in the way that I want to.
Yes. And you expanded the this is what this book does. This book expands the definition of motherhood or mothering, let's say. It expands that definition. And just quickly, my mother had me when she was a teenager and was not prepared for this kind of situation. Yeah. And I have felt quite a vacuum in some ways around my own daughtering, just not, I didn't have enough. So when I became a parent myself, I really felt lost. And I really felt lost and also isolated. And we're going to get into all of these things, because these are, this is the core of this book, because there's a couple of things you do. One, you expand mothering, because what I've realized in the course of the last 10 years of my life, but also in reading this book very specifically, which is why it touched me so much, is how much I've been mothered by other people. Like I have filled that up, you know. Kim mothers me, my editor mothers me, my husband mothers me, you know what I mean? Like I have been nurtured and mothered, and thinking about it in that way expands it, because a lot of our listeners are either, you know, past the point of active mothering or are not parents at all. And this book is relevant for everyone, because we're thinking about mothering as caretaking and an essential role we play in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it as we mother ourselves all the time. Like I'm, you know, before I was talking about the ways that like, that I wanted to be nurtured, that my own mother wasn't able to do that. But I'm also just thinking about the very base, to me, mothering is like, I get up, I listen to my body, I smell my body. I'm like, oh, I need a shower. my body says like, I need, you know, yogurt for breakfast, like feeding yourself, that basic stuff, which is the work that never goes away. We can never outsource that stuff. Just keeping your human body alive, that's mothering. And people, I think it's also very human. Like American culture wants to like beat it out of us and tell us that we don't need other people. And it's like, it's a waste of our time to care for people, especially people who aren't related to us, right? But we really like, I think a lot of us like showing up for other people, and sometimes can show up for other people more than we are able to ourselves.
Yes.
But I think that's a very natural urge. And I just think about how, I mean, I am 44 years old and I didn't get here on my own. None of us gets here on our own. Right. No. And it's a combination. For some people, it's parents. It's mothers, it's fathers, it's aunties, it's grandparents, it's chosen family. It's a really wonderful teacher that you had. It's someone who mentored you, right? There are people in your life and we all take part in this. And I want to expand that and I want to celebrate it because I think that care work and mothering is really the only real work that people have to do as humans.
Oh, wait, talk more about that.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. Keeping yourself alive and cared for, keeping your people alive and cared for, what else is there? Right? Like, that's the real work. It's the work that makes anything else we do in the world possible. Right? And so I think that is like, that's what we need to be talking about. It is hard work. And in America, it is really hard work because we have privatized human rights. So we don't guarantee healthcare. We don't guarantee family leave. We don't guarantee affordable childcare. We don't guarantee education, right? Other countries guarantee this, right? Like,
right.
I believe that these are all things that we deserve simply because we are born.
Yeah. Right?
And doing all of that stuff and keeping ourselves alive in this country is harder than it needs to be. And it's much harder for some people, you know, specifically Black and Brown people than it is for white people. And so I want us to talk about that as work, you know, like that's what it comes down to. And, you know, if I'm really going to go for it, which I will, I think that we should all have a universal basic income to acknowledge that staying alive takes effort. And in this country, it takes money. And I think we should guarantee just a basic life for people, just a floor, a basic floor. You know, it doesn't stop people from being ambitious. It won't stop people from making six figures or having their Tesla, whatever it is they need, right?
Right.
Or want. But it just means that, like, someone who wants to, you know, like, take care of their kids and make some art can do that too, right? Like, can have a nice life.
Right. Yeah. Right. So is the reason you expanded this definition? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of reasons for this, but one thing I saw you say, and I've felt this similarly in my own career in different ways, is that you'd already written a book about motherhood, right?
Yeah.
And you didn't necessarily want to write a second one because then you're going to be in this sort of like mommy writer, right? Zone, right? How did you reconcile that?
So, I mean, again, as I mentioned, I was a food writer. So that I got to write a book at all about pregnancy and mothering was like the opportunity came and I was like, well, I'm not going to say no. If someone wants me to write a book proposal, like an agent's approaching me. And so I wrote this book that, I mean, I think mothering and motherhood and being a mother is endlessly fascinating. I think it's the root of like everything in our culture. It's the beginning of every great story. It's life, right? But we sell it and discuss it as lifestyle. And I, you know, was a participant in seeing how like the culture really makes it niche, really dismisses women's stories. And I just wasn't in the mood to be pigeonholed and like confined to this one place. Right. And so I wasn't going to write another book about mothering. That was like my whole thing. I was going to write this book about bodies, right? Essays. Right. And what happened, the pandemic happened and I wasn't able to, I was taking care of my girls and my original book deadline was July of 2020. And I was like, well, it's never going to fucking happen. Like in April, I was like, no way, not going to happen. But you know, one of the things is I've been thinking a lot about, you know, wanting to get out of under that umbrella of like motherhood, but still like staying true to believing that it was important. But also like a thing that really, so I wrote this book about pregnancy and it was called Like a Mother. And I tried my best to be really inclusive of, you know, trans experience and understanding that we have limitations of gender. And as a 44-year-old person, I feel like I'm still learning.
Yes, and totally.
I got a lot of feedback from people. People wrote to me and I'm grateful to them. I mean, they wrote to me and they said, I think your book is really important and your book really means a lot to me, but I have to tell you, as someone who does not identify as female or who does not identify as a mother, I found like your understanding really limited. I found like your use of gender, like pretty essentialist, you know, and I was like, that's hard to hear, but I was like, yeah, I'll take it. I'll take that criticism. Like, I know that that's true. And so when I had the idea for this book and was like, this is what I want to write about, I wanted to get away from mothering, but I'm like, playing myself here, because in the pandemic, it was so clear, like, care work and mothering and the crisis and the way we devalue that was something I wanted to take on. I just doubled down on it. And I was like, you know, fuck it. People are going to say this is niche. I think this is universal.
Yep.
And I wanted to acknowledge that care work happens in community, like the best sort of caring and mothering. I can't do it alone as a parent. I need my family. I need preschool teachers. I need babysitters. I need friends. But also I heard those voices in my head of people being like, I want to be included. And, you know, I was just like, it cost me nothing. Like, the idea of being a mother has a very personal meaning to me, and it's important to me. But using the word mothering doesn't take away from that experience for me. It just calls more people in. And, you know, especially as a woman of color, like, I want everything I do to be as inclusive as possible. Yeah. And that's just really that's just something that's so important to me. And I certainly am going to fuck up along the way as I do it. But, like, I want to be held accountable to people. I want to learn. I want to grow. And I want to show that there's, like, that's what life is about. Like, I don't know everything. I definitely don't know everything. All I do is learn, and I'm humbled all the time. And so, right. I wanted to, like, I just want to, like, take people along, you know? I just really want to bring everyone as much as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So you're writing this book and you're thinking, okay, yeah. I'm going to bring everybody along. I've taken the notes from my first book. It doesn't hurt me at all to be more expansive. And then let's go back. And then you're like, oh, okay. But I'm going to tell the whole story of my life as well.
Of my entire family.
Of my entire family. And I'm going to talk about my mom. And I'm going to talk about how her parenting affected me, and how her feelings about her own body and food and everything affected me. Okay, yes. So let's talk.
Okay, so yeah, let's go back to the original question. Yes. And I'm grateful for this. So I was like, la, 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 I'm writing a history of caregiving in America. Like, how we got to this place. I mean, I can show you the proposal that I wrote. It had nothing to do with my family. Oh, right? My God. And so, but so my editor, who I love, Julie Will, who was the editor of my first book, she was like, you need a narrative arc. She was like, so the first half of the book is going to be a history of caregiving in America. How do we get to this place in the pandemic where we rely on, like, an invaluable workforce of Black and brown women mainly to do this caregiving work, but we don't pay them and we don't value this. Like, how did we get here? Right. And then the second half of the book is more forward-looking. But so I was in this place where I got my marching orders from my editor, and I spent a month, like, totally paralyzed. I was like, right. I have no idea how to do this. Like, this is a very complex and big topic. And I also know the reason why we don't value care work and expect it, you know, for free or for poverty wages from Black women is because of slavery in America.
Right.
You know, the home has always been a site of work for Black women in this country. And so I was like, how do I deal with this? Because it's really important to reckon with that. But I rely on personal narrative generally, and that's not my story to tell. And I was like, I can be as inclusive as possible. I can be as thoughtful as possible. But, like, I felt really intimidated taking that on. And so I was mostly just, like, swimming in anxiety and totally paralyzed and unable to write anything. And then there was a statistic that came out in COVID that really was just, it changed everything. Mm-hmm. And the statistic was that Filipinx nurses are 4% of the nursing workforce in America.
Okay.
And they are 34% of COVID-related nursing deaths.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's a huge, huge discrepancy. You know, and we saw how people of color were dying disproportionately. And so this, as a Filipina person, I always feel like we don't talk enough about Filipinos. I feel like we're the, like, Rodney Dangerfields of the Asian Americans. Like, we don't really, like, you know, like, we're just not really, we don't talk about it as much. And I feel like our history is not as well known. And so when I heard that statistic, my mom is a nurse. Yeah. And she took care of dying. She was a hospice nurse who took care of people in, like, end stages of life. And I read that statistic and it's like, it will never leave me. I mean, I was like, this could be my mother.
Yeah.
Like, this could be many people I know, actually. You know, like, I think a lot of people have had experience with Filipina nurses, especially, you know, in Southern California. Like, that's definitely, we are here. Like, my people are around. Like, that's a big part of the Filipina American diaspora. And then I kind of was like, wait a second, like, this literally could be my mother. Like, what's the story here? And it made me question, like, oh, okay. So my parents came over in 1970, and it was after the United States Immigration Act of 1965, which lifted quotas for, like, at this, up until this point, America was like, we don't want people from Asia, you know, and we definitely don't want people from the Philippines. It was a very limited number of visas that they allowed.
Okay.
But there was a health worker shortage and a nursing shortage. And so they were like, actually, we're going to allow highly skilled immigrants to come over. And those are my parents. My mother was a nursing, like, was a nurse. My father, who was the first person in his family to go to college, was a doctor. And the reason why my parents are healthcare professionals, it goes back even further. It is because of American colonialism. So okay. A lot of people don't know this, but the Philippines was an American colony for the first half of the 20th century. And one of the things that they did is they established public education systems similar to America, where everyone learned English. So my parents speak English fluently. And they also, the U.S. government established nursing schools and medical schools. And they said it was a way of providing economic opportunity for Filipinos, which is, yes, true. But amongst themselves, U.S. government officials also talked about how doing this was a way of sanitizing a backwards population of people who were inherently diseased and inherently dirty and primitive. You know, that Rudyard Kipling poem, The White Man's Burden, that's written about the Philippines, right? Oh, like, wow. It's about civilizing little brown brothers. And so this is the history that I have always sort of been aware of, but never really had dug into.
Yeah.
And that's when all of this kind of happened within like a week, when I saw this statistic, and then I just started doing this dive into like the history. And that's when I was like, okay, now I'm cooking with gas. Like, this book, I don't have to write about, my ancestors were not enslaved, and I don't have to write about that. Because what happened to my family is different than what happened to African-American families. It's different than what happened to Latinx families, but it is the exact same forces. It's colonialism, it's capitalism, it's white supremacy, it's exploitation. And those forces are the same. And our experiences may be different, but I was like, I can tell the story, and I can tell it through my family. And it's a story that, you know, in some way, like, I mean, I wrote this book in 7 months, which is insanity.
Amazing.
But honestly, Jen, it's like, I wrote it because I've been trying to write this book my whole life.
Yeah.
Like, and that's why it's like, there was like a momentum and an urgency and a primal kind of creativity that kicked in, which I thought through most of the pandemic was dead and I had lost touch with as a creative person. But I was like, no, this is the urgency. This is the story that I want to tell. And that's how it became a memoir. And I'm not trained in memoir. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. So the process of writing it was deeply emotional. There were times when I was like, why am I doing this to myself? Because I was interviewing my parents. I was like trying to ask them about the effects of colonialism. And they were like, what are you talking about? Like, why do you want to like ask these questions? Like, you have a really nice life. Like, why do you want to like criticize the United States? Right. Like, why do you like,
right.
It was really hard. It was really hard, but it was also so gratifying. And I just feel so strongly like this is the book that I was meant to write. And I don't think I could have written it like 10 years ago. There's something about being the age that I'm at, like, and being in this desperate place in the pandemic where I was like, there are just no fucks given at this point. Like, this is my story. This is me. And in writing it, I was like, oh, here she is. Here I am. Yeah. Like, this is who I am at this point in my life. And I feel no shame about that. I feel pride, and I want to celebrate that.
Oh my God. I love that so much, because it's also just, it's exactly where you hope to be at this point in life, you know, this like midlife reset when it's like, okay, I better sort this shit out now. Like, this is it. This is this right here is the moment. Let's take a quick break from some ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And we're back.
I'm excited for your next book. I mean, no pressure, and I'm going to wait. Right? But I think it's a lot about we get to this place in our lives where we're like, okay, like I bought into some things, right?
Yep.
And like, I want to reject those things. I also want to acknowledge that they got me to the place that I'm at. But to me, like, this is the place where you arrive at in middle age where you're like, okay, what really matters is though, who am I now? And what do I want to live for? And who do I want to be going forward? Right? Like, and I feel like I've decided this is what your book is all about. It's a sort of reckoning.
I mean, it is. It's a reckoning. But I mean, I think that's why we write first person books. I mean, but they're so valuable. I couldn't have written my book 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even. This making sense of your life and then sort of like literally closing the book on a lot of things is such a profound feeling. The second that I my book is in revisions, but the second that I finished it, I felt an unbelievable sense of relief unlike I'd ever felt in my life. Just like a palpable movement into another thing. Because I told my story.
Yeah,
I told it the best I could. And I also felt that primal, but painful, incredibly painful to excavate and to get it right and to be fair.
Yeah.
And to not write with malice and to, you know, all of those things, the responsibility of a memoir is something I took really seriously and something I really honored and valued. And I can tell that you do too, that there's a lot of generosity in this book, you know, because you've really thought it out, and that's age, right?
Yeah.
That's
it being is. And there's no substitute for that.
No.
Right. Like it's very, I had too much of an ego, you know, even like probably before I had kids, probably ended like, I mean, having children is a huge ego death, but I think I was on like my path there. Like it was really important to me to be generous to my parents, to myself, but it was also very important to me to be accountable.
Yes.
And that's the thing that was in my head where I was like, I really need to be accountable. Like if I'm going to, I mean, when I gave her a galley because I decided I didn't need her permission. Like I had kept them. I interviewed my parents. I fact checked with my parents, right? I did a lot of hard, honest conversations with them, and they're not readers. They're not, I tried my best to explain, right? But I was like, I don't need their permission. I'm not asking for their permission. I gave my mom a galley to read.
Wow.
And she read it. And it landed like an emotional bomb for her. Like there were a lot of tears. She was like, you write this in the book. She was like, you say that we don't talk about things. Filipinos don't talk about things. She's like, and then you went and put all of our things in a book. And I was like, you're right. I'm a traitor. I'm a massive traitor. Like all right to our families. And you know, it was really hard. And I, you know, I wrote this chapter about pleasure and sex, and I was really frank about my own sex life. And my mom was just like, what is the point of this? Like, what? Do you have your husband's permission? I was like, to write about his semi-hard dick. Yes. I don't need his permission, but I do have it. Right. And she was like, why do you want to do this? And I was like, I want to do this because I want my, like, I was like, we're all here because of sex. And I want my daughters to have, like, frankly, a better sex life than I did up until I was like 30. Right. Yeah. But I think you did. And it was so interesting because I was scared to write that stuff. And like, I'm looking at the person that I know I could probably hurt most in this world. You know, and I feel so secure in my like quote unquote creative and artistic vision, yeah. But I'm looking at her and it was really hard to explain to her, you know, and I was like, I also wrote a lot of, and she also read the book as like an indictment of her failures,
oh,
not as like me, that generosity that I appreciate you noting, like I get it. Like she wasn't in a place at the time. Like we're still on a journey.
Yeah.
You know, and she ultimately was like, they're your story. I'm not going to tell you, you can't do this. She also was like, but you can't expect me to ask any of my friends to read this book. And she's come a long way since then. But yeah, no, I mean, I take it really seriously. It's like, yes. I don't want to, like, it's that like first do no harm, right? Like I don't want to hurt anyone. And there were drafts where I definitely was like, why am I describing my mother this way? Or the way my dad said something. And I was like, that's me editorializing. And like, it really takes, it's humbling. And you really have to be willing to like confront your own biases and like confront the part of you that is like bitter and a little bit ugly.
Yes.
And like you really have to do all of that. And it's hard. It's hard fucking work.
It's hard painful. Fucking work. And the part of you that's like still a little child brat. That's
right.
Like,
oh, well, totally.
I want to set this right.
Let the record show, right?
I was mad.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, but I mean, like, and I'm mad and I'm still like, I get around my mother and I like, it's funny. It's like, I feel like she interacts with me sometimes where I'm like, how old do you think I am? Like, but also it's like, I'm sure she thinks the same thing where I show up at her house and suddenly I'm like 22.
Yes.
I'm like rolling my eyes. Like, yes. I'm a grown ass woman and I'm like, mom.
Oh, this sort of infantilization that just happens at the threshold of my parents' home.
No. You know, like, it's very powerful. And it's like, there's nothing you can do to stop it. And so, and you know, it's happening and you still can't stop it.
No, I know.
I want to go back to what you were saying though, because I haven't talked much about this and it made me so happy. I felt it in my body when you were like, when I finished, I felt this like relief, like this feeling of like, this is behind and I'm going forward. Can you like talk some more about that? Because I feel something similar and I just love to hear more about that and dwell in that space for a minute.
I mean, look, you know, my book is about trauma, a lot about trauma and about how trauma led me to workaholism. And mm-hmm. It is a lot about, it's an addiction memoir, really. And uh-huh. It's about my addiction to work. And so I am reframing and reconsidering mm-hmm. everything I thought about work and working and achievement and accomplishment, all of that, which is a lot, right? Because you're writing a lot and also exposing your trauma and having it not be trauma porn is like a very how do I do this and not traumatize the reader and whatever.
Yeah.
And it was so hard. It was so hard. Like I developed all sorts of like physical ailments as I was writing it. Uh-huh. I abandoned my family for a month because I was so lost in it. I at one point said to my husband, I need to leave you for a month. I have to. I'm not going to be able to finish this. It needs to be that internal. And I went to a cabin in Iceland. Like it was like it had to be that severe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I felt, even if no one ever read this book or even if no one reads this when it comes out, I knew I had done it for me, which was the first time I had ever really thought about work for me and not to please others, not to be a good girl, not, you know, for anything. Yeah. And it was that, which I think men feel a lot, like straight cis, you know, white men feel a lot. Mm. Yeah, this is for me. They sort of squash buckle like in the places, you know?
Yeah.
But my whole life.
Because they're entitled, they grow up and feeling entitled to be themselves at all points, you know?
Yes.
Which I'm like, in a way, I'm like, that's fine.
That's
I just
great.
Want all of us to have that feeling too.
And I really yes. just was like, I love what you said about permission, because I didn't ask for permission. I mean, my parents haven't seen my book yet, and I'm going to wait until it's a little further along, and then I want to have a conversation with them, but before it's locked and, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
But that accomplishment, taking the big swing that you were always afraid to take, I hid in my work so much. Even in, I mean, I hid as a manager. I hid because I was afraid to be too creative. I hid because I thought my stories weren't compelling enough. I hid, you know, oh, I'll write about a pair of jeans, but really it's about, you know, this fucked up thing that happened when I was 17. I was always using devices and always hiding. Mm-hmm. And to stop doing that for a sustained project. And I also wrote my book in about 7 months, and it was like a bullet, because it was just like, this has to happen. This is just it. And that moment that you did it, I was just like, I don't know if I've ever felt that level of satisfaction. Like, I think it was better than any sex I've had. Like,
you know what? So, I mean, what I hear, and there's a lot that you just said that I relate to, that there's similarities. What I hear and how I describe this is like, I'm looking at you through my Zencaster screen. You're free.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like to me. It's like getting free.
Right.
And that is how I felt. Like for me, like my children are young. They're 7 and they're 4. So they were like 6 and 3 when I was writing this book. And I couldn't get away for 1 month, but the book got done because my husband, he was like, pull up your Google calendar. And we sat down, and from like April to October, he was like, every 3 weeks, you're going to go away. You're going to go away for a week. You can go for up to a week, but you need to go away for a minimum of like 3 or 4 days. And I'm telling you, like, I've got this, like, this is my turn to like, to do this. And, I mean, like, fucking bless him. Shout out Will Pitts. Like, I couldn't have done it without him.
Right.
And I was like, initially I was hesitant because I think the pandemic also conditioned me to being like, no, I couldn't possibly go away.
Yes.
But the thing is, once I started going, I got better at it.
Yes.
And I fully had to, I mean, I'm in the middle of a moment here in my life being back at home post-tour where I'm like, oh, I got this book done because to a certain extent I have checked out from my family.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what was necessary to do my work.
Yes.
And every week that I went away, I got better at it. And there were some weeks where I was scheduled to go away for like the full 7 days. And I came back after like 4 because not because I missed them, not because I felt guilty, but because I knew it would be that much harder for me to come back at the end of the week. Like, I wouldn't want to. And that's the thing that you know, there's a part of me that does feel a little bit of guilt about that. But hearing you talk about it, it was like, no, like, this is what the work requires. This is what it requires of me. And the other thing that I want to say is that, you know, this is my second book and I had no idea what was going to happen with it. And I just felt like, again, as I described, like, I've never felt so free. Like, I decided I was going to write about my Filipino family and I was not going to, there is not one explanatory comma in this book. Right?
Right.
Tagalog words show up. Dishes show up. I do not explain what they are. I've been explaining myself to white people my whole life. And I was like, I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it this time around. And if no one reads it, except for someone like me, because this is the book that I would have wanted. This is for like Pinay women. This is for first gen Pinay women. It's really for myself. And I had this talk with my husband where I said, like, you know, there's a joke about like the second book curse or whatever. Like, people it's not going to be as good. And I was like, I don't know what is going to happen with this book. And I need to be really clear about what success is for me.
Yes.
And I was like, success to me with 2 children under 7 during the pandemic is that I fucking wrote this book in the first place.
Yes.
And I feel so proud of what I wrote. I stand by it. I know it's all its flaws and I'm not going to get started on that, but I was like, no, I did it. And this is me. And what you said there, like, there's just no replacement for that.
There's nothing.
And it is like the greatest feeling I've ever had. I feel very free. And the strange thing is that it's like the reception for the book has been a thing I didn't anticipate. And before I would have been like, I would have like 4 years ago, if this had happened with my first book, I would have been like, you know, it's amazing, but it's like, I don't need it. Like, it's incredible, but no, it would have like warped me. And this time around, I just feel so like, it's just gravy. It's truly gravy. I'm also like, bathe me in gravy, bitch.
Yes.
But I also, like, in the end, like, the thing that matters to me most is the thing that no one sees.
Yes.
It's the thing that's like, I talked about it with my therapist. I made a long-term plan for my mental health before book launch. And I was like, this is like my walled city. Like, yeah, what this means to me and what this book has been and what I have to say is like a thing that no one can touch.
Yeah.
Like, I did the damn thing. I did it.
You did the damn thing. And I want to talk.
And you did too.
And I did too. But I want to talk a little bit about mothering and partnership. So one thing I didn't say was that when I took that month off, that was after I had done all the childcare, all the schooling. My husband wrote 2 books in the first year of the pandemic, and he would go out to the garage at 8 in the morning, and he would, which is where his office is. It's very sad, but it's not nice, but it was fine. It's a way.
Door.
He would go out like Mr. Brady with a briefcase to the garage at 8 in the morning, and then come in at, you know, 6 or 7 at night to dinner on the table after I had done Zoom school all day, all the laundry, all the cooking, whatever. And so I did this for a year plus and then was like, listen, and I had never asserted myself like this. And I was like, how are they going to live without me for a month? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I stole it. I was like, I found a cheap writer's residency in Iceland where I could get like a cabin for $600 for the month. And I just was like, that's it, right?
Filing this way.
I stole it because I knew I had to, and it was important to me.
Yeah.
And I had not put myself first the entire pandemic, right?
Yeah.
So what I want to talk about is, I think that when we're thinking about partnership, and especially in, you know, cis heteronormative monogamous relationships with our romantic partners, it's often unbalanced. The caregiving is often unbalanced, right? And it can foster so much resentment. What do you think? Because you write about this, so I'm leading you. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, but no, please, I'm leading you.
I want you to talk about how you think we create better systems. Because this resentment, you know, it makes you forget your love for your partner. You know, it's so hard to work this stuff out. And I have a very good partner in a lot of ways, but I still wind up doing more of the work because I see more of the work than he does.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I could turn off the part of me that is like constantly monitoring, like, is the seat of those pants getting threadbare? Like,
yes.
Who's thinking about the next size, right? Like, when we talk about making, I've had to let go of a lot of things. Like, there is a term that it's the first time I encountered it, because I hate everything to do with like mommy wars, mommy influencers. Yes. Like, I just don't give a shit about any of that stuff. Like, that's not what's interesting to me about motherhood and parenting and mothering and that kind of work. But, you know, there's this thing called maternal gatekeeping. I don't know if you've ever heard this.
No, no.
And as someone who used to, like, my husband would put in dishes in the dishwasher and I'd be like, I'm sorry, that's not how you load a dishwasher. And I would like redo it, right? And it was very like, I know how to do this stuff better. But like that kind of maternal gatekeeping, like, I'll just do it myself, which is like fucking martyrdom. And I saw my mother do that, you know, and like, and I was like, I don't want to live like this. Right? Yeah. And so it's been like sort of a journey. And I think the pandemic also for me was like, I did more of the caretaking. But when my husband was like, let me do this stuff, I got to a point and it was, you know, I was like depressed. I was clinically depressed, you know, but I was just like, I have to let go because there's no way forward.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so I've had to be like, I mean, now it's like, I was going to say though, like that toll, like it's all that mental work in the mind. I think it starts in pregnancy if you are like the birth parent of a child, because you're like, my life changed like a full 10 months before my husband's did.
Yeah.
Like the baby was theoretical to him. Me, I was like, my boobs hurt, my stomach's expanding, like I can feel my uterus up against my lungs. Like, you know, I was like, you don't understand what I'm going through. Right. Like,
no, and even mentally, like quitting drinking, you know, and they're still able to drink and party and be normal with their friends. I mean, not necessarily party because we're old, but you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah. No, but also like, should I have the sushi? Like everything, right?
Yes.
Like
yes.
All of those kinds of things, even if you reject them, like the messages are so pervasive and the extent to which like even of you know, like a deeply feminist person, like has internalized some of that stuff. It's hard to confront.
Yes.
So there's, I think that those, the message is coming both from inside the house and from outside the house, which is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, what I've had to do is realize like when I think about making dinner, I'm thinking about it like 24 hours in advance or like that morning. Whereas when my husband is making dinner, he's like, what do we have in the fridge at like 5:20?
Yes.
And I'm like, this is madness.
Yes.
And that's stereotyping, but I think like that's the reality. Like that's how it is. And I have an incredible partner. And even then I'm like, what are you thinking about half the
How?
So one of the things that I do, and I don't have like, there's, and I should say this, like there's no fucking quick solution. There's no silver bullet. There's no thing. I think it is really talking about it is the number one step. Like I name the work that I am doing. Like I say, like, I've heard you say you're going to make this vaccination appointment for our daughter. I've heard you say it 4 days in a row. Has it happened? Because I'm at a point where I'm just going to do it if you don't do it. Right? Like, and he'll like, and he'll do it. And we talk, I mean, I also hate, there's an element, like when you commit to someone and again, are in like a monogamous, cis, like hetero, like long-term relationship, like it is, it's very, it's boring. You spend time in like logistical negotiations. Like if I knew that this is what marriage and having children would be like, I might not have done it. It's unglamorous. It's just the stuff that's necessary.
It's not sexy. It's not sexy.
It's not sexy. So I think there's that. So I definitely think it's really about like, I mean, it sounds so cheesy, but it's like honest, open communication before the resentment kicks in, right? Just to name it and to also be very clear and be like, I'm trying to tell you what I want and what I need. This is not personal. This is not me being mad at you. This is me preventing myself from being mad at you. I say this all the time to my husband. And so we have these like exchanges. You know, I was on book tour for the last month. I came back and he was like, I gotta be honest. He's like, I had it down for the last 2 weeks. You've been gone and I've been locked in with these girls and you come in and you're trying to like parent. And that's hard for me. And I was like, damn, okay. Because I feel that way. I felt that way about him when he would go away. And I had to be like, step back. Like, can my family live without me? Yeah, it turns out they can. Right?
Yes.
And that's like, so like a little bit of letting go of that. The other thing I want to say, though, is really, and this is a lot of what the book is about. Like, we are not meant. If it feels like too much to cook 3 meals a day, 7 days a week, and keep your house clean and do the laundry, it's because it is too much.
Yeah.
Like, no person can do all of that.
Yeah.
And so that's just like the domestic labor, but raising children and taking care of people, it's not something we're meant to do in isolation. It's not something I think about single parents all the time or unpartnered parents. I really have no idea how they do it because I can't do it with just my husband. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like we hired an amazing woman named Olga and her team to come in and do a deep clean of our house the first time. Cause we're people who are like, we don't need that. We can do it ourselves. But they just cleaned our house and they were here for like 5 hours. And I was like, the house feels totally different. And like, we're in a place where we can afford that right now. But I just think about ways like that expansiveness, like calling people in, like I just can't do family life without my partner, without my parents who live nearby, without like my friend Becca, without my friend Kate, without my friend Alex. I can't do it without our babysitter Penelope. I can't, it's just, so I think part of it to counter that resentment and to counter that sort of tension is to make it a shared responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, like I have friends who don't have kids who like, they are very unbothered by taking care of my kids for like 2 hours.
Yes.
And I like cherish that freedom and they get something from that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's all the stuff of community building and decentering yourself and your ego, and it's slow work, but I cannot think of better work to be doing.
No. And it is that, it is asking yourself, cause I now have a 12-year-old and, my sister who just moved across the country, but had been close to me for a while. And she had two small kids and a five-year-old and a 2-year-old, which is just madness. Right.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa.
Been and, there. Yeah.
Exactly. And I did a lot of caretaking of those kids, you know, watched them for 4 days by myself, you know, had them over for a full day. It just a full exhaustion.
Yeah.
But I find myself more and more tracking where do, and I wouldn't have put it this way until reading your book, but where do I have the opportunity to help? Where do I have the opportunity to mother?
Mm.
Because I also equally miss those like very that sort of like potent nurturing that happens when the babies when they're babies, right? Once you have a 12-year-old, they're like screaming at you, and you know, it's like a different it's a beautiful and wonderful challenge that I am up for, but it is different.
And because they're I'm a whole person here now.
I'm a whole person. Like back,
you have to explain everything. Yeah,
exactly. Back off. Let me individuate a little bit. Yeah, you know, I don't want to cuddle with you. You know, like and so I've really sought those. I think that that's something we should be doing, is thinking of ways, if we're not actively parenting, mothering, thinking of ways, seeking out opportunities to be giving that kind of nurturing, caretaking, because it's so rewarding, even if it's exhausting, but it's also perspective giving. Yeah. It's just another way to think about spending our time, you know, extra time that we have. It's something I've experienced. I wonder how you think about that, because it's also community building, right? Like, everybody likes to take care of their kids.
I think we're talking about the same thing. And I think I'm interested in expanding it even more. I mean, I think about, we all have care energy. I want to say this because it's human nature. We are social and we are interdependent. Like, we just are, right?
Yeah.
We all, everyone, whether they have children or not, like, we're social and we are needful. We're humans.
Yeah.
And so I think about how much better our society would be if our care energy didn't get trapped at home. It gets trapped in the home. And also, even if you're like a single person living alone, you direct it a lot to yourself, right? Yeah. But I don't know how to, sometimes I've thought about like, can we incentivize with tax breaks, like single people, like volunteering at a daycare or like taking care of children? How can we like going and hanging out at an old folks home, playing chess in the park, like that sort of intergenerational, even interspecial, right? Like go volunteer at your community garden, right? Like go people foster animals, right? All of that stuff I see as being related, right? Yeah. Like I will still value people over, you know, like an environmental cause or an animal. It's true. I, you know, like people are more important to me, but all of that stuff is life and we're like tied together. And I think that everyone has some care energy that they want to give and it's very rewarding. And I think one of the tricky things is that it's really hard to describe that, that emotional psychological reward, that like warm, fuzzy feeling. Like it can't be like packaged, right? It has no monetary value. And so I think it's a hard sell sometimes. But I think once people start engaging in that, it feels so good, right?
Like, and that idea of interdependence, that interdependence, you know, I found early, I hated mommy groups when I first had my child. I did not belong to any of them. My best mom friend was a gay dad. And but I did feel isolated often because the communities they were just mostly in Brooklyn, at least they were like white and rich and not aligned with my values. And, you know, I didn't have a nanny and I probably could have used one. I could have afforded one, but I didn't like that whole, I didn't like the whole setup of it, you know?
Yeah.
So we had a daycare and that was great. And I loved our daycare, but I do think of feeling, I wish that I had felt more like I could tap into a community that didn't feel so performative. I felt like the early motherhood felt so performative and I had such a hard time finding my community in that.
Yeah.
And I think that it's because the way we think about it is so small. The way we think of community in early motherhood is so narrow. Mm-hmm. And thinking about it more expansively, like what you're talking about is so much smarter. But also, I did want to say something that you pointed out in your book, that how much we have devalued caregiving and made that kind of labor invisible. And I didn't know this. I didn't know that that caregivers live in poverty. I forget what the stat was, but it's like
three times more likely to live in poverty than any other worker. And that's just staggering. I mean, these statistics are, I'm glad you brought this up because I was I knew it, but I didn't, I had not seen the figures.
Yeah.
And they're really, I mean, I felt ashamed, like, as a country, like, as an individual, you know, like, we paid the, you know, the woman, we did a nanny share when my oldest daughter was a baby, and we, like, each of the families paid the caregiver, like, a minimum of $15 an hour, and we gave her raises. But anyway, like, and that was each of us for the hours that she was working. Right. But so, but yeah, let's talk about these statistics. So, you know, the median wage for any industry, the median wage for any worker in America is like close to $20 an hour,
okay,
which is still not enough to live off of, but okay, so that's what it is. But for domestic workers, the median wage is closer to $12 an hour. Mm-hmm. There's a huge drop off.
Yeah.
And then the lowest median wage of any worker in America is a nanny, and that's $11.60. And then I think about it like this. So, like, that's why I think a lot of these solutions, though, are like, they're so antithetical to how we live, but they're kind of simple and common sense, like, to value care, right? It seems very obvious. Like, and I think about how the majority of people who do caregiving, hired caregivers, are women of color, and they are also mothers themselves.
Yeah.
So then I think about, like, what if the woman that we had hired, Maria, who I love, and I just ran into her the other day at the Safeway, and it was like tears, right? And my oldest daughter, who doesn't really remember her, was like, who is this lady? Like, why are you hugging her, right? But I mean, this woman is so important to me, but she brought her son, Bruce, little 3-year-old Bruce, like, to take care of the kids every day. And we were like, of course you can bring your child, because, like, who's taking care of the caregiver's children, right?
Right.
And so I think about that. Like, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel like you might have felt a different type of way if you hired a nanny who could bring kids with her, and then your child has a baby, and then, you know, your child has somebody else to play with, and it's like it's a group thing. Like, it doesn't have to be individualized. It doesn't all have to be private. We make everything private, and it's really to our loss and detriment.
Yes, that is it. It is that weird thing, that weird, oh my God, we're just going to hoard all this. We're just going to hoard all this, this energy and this, our whole, we're going to hoard our lives weirdly and keep them contained in these weird ways. When really it's like, I don't know if that's because of fear and shame.
I think it's fear, shame. I think it's also just what we've been conditioned to in America. And I think it's really important. I tell myself this all the time, like, you know, like, modern American life has been, like, it's relatively recent invention, right? As we were seeing, like, democracy is an experiment. It's not going very well, right? Like, in this country, right?
Right.
And so the way that people, this is not to romanticize or exoticize, but really, like, all around the world, the way people lived for centuries was communally, like, more community. Communally, men were not responsible for being breadwinners. The home was not the sole provenance of women. Like, everybody kind of did everything.
Yeah.
And I want us to go back to that, you know, and I think the pandemic is really, like, the pods we formed, these different things are, and mutual aid and little free libraries and community fridges. It's everyone saying, I can't do this alone. And it's an opportunity to lean more into that, because that's actually how we should be living. And I think people really, when pressed, will admit, like, it feels better.
Yeah.
It does feel better. It's inefficient, right? Like, sometimes you're like, what am I doing? I'm standing here talking to this neighbor for 20 minutes about their, like, ingrown toenail, but that's just what you do sometimes. You just showing up for people means, and then, you know, and then they're going to give you, like, kale from their garden. Like, it's just, you know, it's cool. It's life. Like, it's so much more real. And it's so much more satisfying.
And connected. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So what do you still want to do?
In my life? God, I want to figure out how to make sure I never have to go to an office again to work. I think I'm on my way.
Amen.
There.
Amen. Yes.
I want to... make sure I want to raise, like, good, happy people who feel like they are enough and who will be, like, wonderful travel companions. I want to go travel with my girls, and my husband, and just, like, sort of live free for, like, a year or something. We did that after we got married. And so I'd love to be able to do that with my girls. I want to make sure that my parents are taken care of, like, in the as they're getting older and yeah. towards the end of their life. And I don't know, I just want to have a good time.
Awesome.
Here for awesome. A good time, not for a long time.
That's right. That's it, man. That's it. Okay. All right.
That's my vibe. What about you?
I want to just, I don't know, man.
I'm the worst interview because I'm always like, what about you? What do you think?
I want to write more books. I mean, professionally, I want to write many more books. I love it. Right. I want to keep doing. I want to tell some stories. I want to, and I want to find space in my life to feel, to take the emphasis out of my brain and onto other people better. Mm. That is a massive goal. And, you know, I want to raise, I want to continue raising a ethical, confident child. You know, I feel like it's the fear and the shame in children that, you know, brings us into the world and makes us go in ugly directions. So I'm really trying to work on that.
Yeah. It's really like, I'm not just saying this. I truly believe this, you know, raising children and having a relationship with small people is like some of the most important work we can be doing, because it is really like the health and future of our society, you know?
Yeah.
Like, my daughters know so much more and believe they are entitled and worthy of so much more that I had to, like, it took me years to figure that out. So.
Oh yeah. When my kid says to me, Mom, I'm setting a boundary. I'm like, what?
My work here is done.
Exactly. I just am like, all right, the conversation over. Fantastic. Yeah. All right. Where can people find you, Angela? Also, they're going to find your book. I'll link to it, but where can they find
you? Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's pretty simple. I'm angelagarbez.com for my website. I have this Substack that I think I might start writing on. I don't know. I have to, right now writing feels like violence to me, being forced to write anything. So I'm going to do that.
But my God, is that not the truth? Is that not the fucking truth?
I'm like, my agent was like, do you have ideas? I'm not putting pressure, but do you have ideas for another book? And I was like, listen, I have ideas, but I don't want to write anything for a year.
The well is dry. I need some time.
I'm taking all of August off. So, but the place that I think I'm actually more active, that's actually still feels fun to me, is Instagram. And I'm just Angela Garbez on Instagram. And I am actually, it turns out, quicker to respond to a DM than I am to an email. But yeah, I love hearing from readers, and I love like connecting with people, being out of my brain and just like feeling good and connecting. So yeah, feel free to find me.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Oh my God, thank
you.
This was such a pleasure. I was looking forward to meeting you and talking to you, and this is even just like even better than I thought it was going to be.
Oh,
so I appreciate you so much.
Me too. Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, please rate and review it on all the platforms. It really makes a difference. Please don't give us bad reviews, because we hate them and sometimes they make us cry. And also, we also don't need to know if you are not going to follow the show anymore. We respectfully accept your absence. If you want to follow the show on social media, we're at EIF Podcast. We're also on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're with a private Facebook group. We're also on LinkedIn. We have an email address at everythingisfinethepodcast@gmail.com. You can find Kim on her blog, girlsofacertainage.com. You can find me on tinyletter.com/Jennifer Romolini. The show is mixed and edited by the great Natalie Rivera. Thank you so much, Natalie, and we will be back next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.